Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. My name is Michael Silverblatt. Today my guest is Vikram Chandra. He's the author, most recently, of Love and Longing in Bombay, a collection of stories from Little Brown. They've also brought out from their Back Bay imprint his first novel, Red Earth and Pouring Rain, in paperback. And I wanted to begin by acknowledging that we share something of a background. Among your writing teachers were John Barth and Donald Barthelme, who were mentors and enormously influential figures in my life. So I can't help but ask you to begin with what led you to them.
When I understood and realized that I was going to try and write a novel, I thought I needed a place to live and exist while I was doing this, and the resources of a university. So the Johns Hopkins program seemed a good place to start at, and that's where I met John Barth, who became enormously influential in the structuring of the book, had interesting and precise things to say about craft. I thought actually that I'd take a year to write this book, and at the end of the first year, I hadn't even gotten my protagonist born, so at that point, it became clear that there was a problem. Jack asked, well, what are you going to do next? And I said, well, I don't know. So he said, you know, maybe you should think of going to Houston, where Donald Barthelme runs a program. So that's how I ended up in Houston, where I spent the next 5 years getting this thing done.
So it took 6 years to write the first novel.
Altogether.
Now, I'm curious, one of the heroes of that first novel, Red Earth and Pouring Rain, is a typewriting monkey. And I know, I love a comment in a Louis Simpson poem. It's a recent poem. He's talking about the numbers of monkeys at typewriters that it would take to produce Hamlet. And in the poem, his wife says, well, Shakespeare was the monkey who produced Hamlet.
Exactly.
But I did want to talk to you about that idea of randomness. Randomness and structure seem to be the poles of that novel.
Right. Well, there's this old, very old Indian tradition of storytelling, which has stories within stories within stories in a sort of recursive manner. And the great Indian epics, the Ramayana and the Mahabharata, both follow that structure. And there's an apparent shapelessness, a sort of confusion, to which the Western eye, especially, I think, reacts with terror when it confronts it. So, I mean, even in if you think architecturally of the front of a big Hindu temple in South India, those big, huge pyramid-like structures covered with thousands and thousands of sculptures. So that became for me the model for structuring this book. And then also the rhetoric that went on within colonial times about the shape of Indian narrative and its relative virtues as compared to the clean Aristotelian narrative, which was supposed to be the way that one told a story. So within the book itself, those rhetorics sort of encounter each other and collide.
Colonial and classical.
Right.
Now, of course, John Barth, as a writer, is someone who's always recurring to the story of Scheherazade and to those stories within stories of the Arabian Nights, not just those, but the ocean of story as well. And, in addition, the problems of translating stories from within certain traditions to others that have no receptivity for them. So it would seem almost as if for that book, Barth would have been an ideal teacher.
Absolutely, right. I think he saw it clearly in the very first stuff that I brought into workshop, what it was going to do, and perhaps even sooner than I did, because I actually, when I started writing it, I didn't have clearly in my head this structure, this branching structure. But then it became very clear in the first 30 pages that it was going to do that. And I think also within the book itself, one of the problems that I was interested in was how do you translate that older tradition, which in my head exists in Hindi and Sanskrit, into English. In fact, one of the characters in the book, Sanjay, actually says something like, in English, the true heart and soul of a nation is forever left unsaid. And so the problem was, how do you say in English something that you can't say in English?
Mm-hmm.
And so then the form of the book, I think, for me, was an attempt to answer that question.
Love and Longing in Bombay, the new book of stories by my guest Vikram Chandra, is a similar book in that questions of absence are central. But this book takes place virtually entirely in India, mostly in Bombay. And I began to wonder, is it written for an American audience or just in America? Because the book seems very self-conscious in using Indian phrases and making very few concessions to a reader who is not yet familiar with the topography.
Right. Well, my audience is Indian in my estimation. I mean that quite literally. I write specifically for a few people, that is my sisters and one friend of mine who's American but is familiar with India, and my mother and a couple of other people. So literally those are the people that I see when I write, and I send them by post or by email what I've written pretty soon after I've written it, and then they talk back at me. So in Red Earth and Pouring Rain, there's that the monkey sits inside a house talking to an immediate family that sits around the typewriter listening to what he's writing. And then outside on the maidan or the field, there are concentric circles of other listeners, this larger audience, which is also listening. So I think, at least for me as a writer, I find it impossible to imagine a larger audience. I mean, who are they? I have no idea who they are. So I write for that inner circle, and if other people are listening, eavesdropping, that's very good for me, but I can't think of them.
On the page before the final page of Love and Longing in Bombay, what we call the penultimate page,
yes,
among those of us who are multisyllabic, we learn for the first time the person's name to whom these stories are being told. And what interests me is that in the conventional way of structuring frame tales and stories, the frame is what's defined first.
Right.
Here we learn on the last page what the outermost layer of narrative transmission is. A young man in Bombay is being told stories in a smoky bar by a older man.
Right.
The young man is a computer programmer, and it seems as if in an almost preternatural way the older man is telling stories that are meant to heal him,
right,
without our being told exactly what his problems are. The young man's problems are suggested, but not directly named. He seems to be, one, homesick, two, recovering from a relationship that's gone awry, three, consequently suffering some kind of sexual confusion that may have to do with the death of a sibling early on, or at least a disappearance of a mirroring figure.
Right.
And to be entertaining a kind of yearning toward marriage. Marriage at all costs, perhaps with someone who might tell him stories.
Right.
Am I doing okay?
Absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. That's a pretty fair profile, I think. I suppose both the listener and the teller, I wanted somehow an absent on the page. So mm-hmm. that is, that you get a sense of both of them more through the story that is being told and listened to rather than an editorial voice telling us who they are. So, I mean, I suppose it's kind of obvious that the stories that are told are the teller's voices. They're Subramanyam's yearnings and loves and longings that are contained within them. And then also I'm hoping that also in some sense the listener is contained in those stories.
Mm-hmm.
So that somehow suggestively through the erotic act of telling a story and listening to it, we get a sense of the two human beings who are involved with each other. And they're more at the table, but primarily these two.
Well, in the final story, which is the most complicated in terms of its narrative structure, or the most inversions
right.
occur, there is a story about the function of storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
A young man has come back to India and told about the bomb that has exploded in Japan.
Right.
The children in the village are slowly experiencing cracks
right.
that hairline fractures that seem to extend and extend, and it's not until a mother tells a praising story
right.
that the cracks begin to heal. So somehow or other, growing up is presented as a process of fracturing, and that modernity seems to be something that only increases the possibility of fracture, the bomb, computers, computer programs, forms of communication that are not face-to-face and that may be destructive or manipulated. And stories seem to be the mediating or healing possibility.
Right.
Now, I wonder, do you really think that, or is that a convenient metaphor?
I suppose I really do believe that. And I suppose I mean it also that when story stops, then nothing exists. That we exist, in a sense, as narrative creatures in the most ordinary ways. I suppose also this has something to do with the old Hindu idea of existence as an encounter with Maya, which is usually translated as illusion. But I think it means more the sort of slippery perceptual apparatus that surrounds us. In other words, the world is a story we tell ourselves about the world. And when you disrupt that storytelling, what exists is it's not even chaos, it's a vacuum. So I think for me, the narrative act is the primal act. It's the one that comes first, and must be revived again and again, and lost again and again, in a sort of endless cycle, to make life happen.
Well, you mentioned Maya. The stories are each of them given a name. In only one, the story Shanti is the name a figure that appears
right.
in the story. And true to form, most American reviewers that I've read don't mention this or do the mm-hmm. footwork or question the story's titles. Now, I am fortunate enough to have you here so that you can help me through. But can you tell me about the titles of these tales?
Sure. In the Hindu understanding of life, you're born into the world, and then you have four aims or purposes, which are namely dharma, which is usually translated as duty, I think badly. I think a better translation would be something like the way, or what you must become in the wheel. So there's dharma, there's earth, which is material gain. It's what you feed yourself with, it's what you give back to the world. There is kam, which is pleasure, sexual but also all other kinds of pleasure. And then finally, moksh, which means liberation or release from the endless cycle of rebirth. So the stories in this collection are titled, the first one is dharma, which is a ghost story and attempts to explore some other possible meanings of that word. The second one is something that sort of entered the collection at an angle And so I put it in there, even though its title doesn't follow the structure. It's called Shakti, which is Sanskrit for power or energy, and also can mean goddess. Power within the Hindu cosmos also is always feminine. And Shakti is a story of social climbing in Malabar Hill, which is at the southern tip of Bombay.
And a really funny story. it has that quality of those goddesses who competed for Paris's attention,
right.
when awarding the golden apples of the sun. These are women who are very much determining the economic future of India.
Right, exactly. Right. And then the third story is Kama, which is my attempt at a detective story, which was the hardest thing I've ever done, I should tell you. But it has Sartaj Singh, who's a Sikh policeman, who is investigating what seems to be a common robbery murder, which turns out to be much more complicated and has as its center a kind of sexual secret or sexual secrets. The fourth story is Arth, which means gain, economic gain, and it's a hard story to describe. It moves from the world of art and painters to the world of programmers who are trying to make a killing in the software market, and the underworld of Bombay, which feeds off the speculation in real estate and the booming real estate market. And I suppose it's about ambition and all of those things. And then the final one, Shanti. Shanti literally meaning peace, or as T.S. Eliot used it at the end of The Wasteland, the peace that passeth understanding, he puts in his footnote, which I suppose I thought of as some sort of analog to moksha. But Shanti is a love story, and in it, the teller of the tales reveals something about himself by telling that story.
Now, in the fourth story, a man loses his lover, his male lover, to the gangster underworld and receives in his place a painting by an artist who one senses is pretentious, disloyal, unfaithful, but who has captured something of the energy of the missing man, as if in some crazy sense art is simultaneously insufficient and more than sufficient.
Yeah.
And I wondered if you could talk about that.
Right. Well, yes, I think the painter, Anubhav, is, as Iqbal describes him, Iqbal is the man who loses his lover. He says Anubhav is a leech, a liar, and a whore, and yet I owe him for his talent. Which is to say, quite obviously, that I don't think artistic talent has anything to do with moral virtue, which is what Iqbal seems to realize at the end of the story. And yes, that in some rich way, art suggests to us all that we lose, all that we yearn for, everything that exists outside of our grasp, and yet in some inexplicable way is made available to us in these flecks of paint on canvas. And so, in some way, perhaps doesn't heal us, but at least it gives us a way to survive this wilderness that exists at the end of the story.
I'm speaking to Vikram Chandra, the author most recently of Love and Longing in Bombay, a collection of stories. Now, oddly enough, that painting put me in mind of some of the other representations in the book, mostly representations of gods and goddesses. And I began to wonder what the relationship is in Hindu culture to the representation of gods.
Right. Well, I suppose in some direct way, I'm an idol worshiper. I trust form. I like the surfaces of things. I like to touch them. And I think to be able to trust the surface of a thing is to worship it. And I suppose that it is in direct contradiction with the kind of idea or the kind of thinking that says that the truth is always something that's far behind the curtain. I think sometimes the truth is on the surface. And so the idea in traditional Hindu culture is that the idol represents, the idol itself is sacred, because in the slippery veil of Maya, it's a vortex of energy that becomes sacred because you worship it.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore the relationship between you and the idol is meaningful, and you can actually get close to divinity by feeding the idol or rocking it in your hand. So I like very much that idea, and so the surface of the story itself, I think, is meaningful.
Well, because it occurred to me as I was reading and trying to fit together the worldview or cosmogony implicit in these stories, that in certainly the Judeo-Christian tradition, it's a tradition of iconoclasm, the destruction of the representation of the god, that the god should be unrepresented, and that goes hand in hand with the Platonic tradition and therefore the Aristotelian position in narrative, that finally truth is unrepresentable and goals unreachable. There seemed to be a distinct difference here in that truth is reachable and its absence is also acceptable. The characters by the end of these stories, if the solutions have not come, what has come is acceptable as solution. Solution does not have to be final.
Right. There's a couplet from the Mahabharata which goes something like, the images sweat in the temples and the truth is hard to find. And I think the realization at the ends of, I suppose, many of these stories is that, exactly as you put it, that we only have provisional truths, which doesn't mean that they're any less. There is no one great truth, but all these surfaces finally reveal to us something real about life. The very last sentence of the book, the narrator, Ranjit Sharma, says something like, if we search together, we may find not heaven or its opposite, but only life itself. And so I think through these sort of shards arranged against each other, this representation is an attempt to find something true about life, not necessarily the truth, but a few scattered ones.
What's lovely here is that while the stories have, one comes to suspect, a theoretical matrix that generates them, they also have a very strong physical connection to life. And in fact, there are two erotic set pieces, one of them heterosexual, one homosexual, that sort of stand as, what would you say, pillars in the book for the fleshy world, you know, and its importance. And I wondered if you could talk about that.
As I was saying earlier, I tell my stories for people that actually do read them or listen to them pretty shortly after. And my sisters are a tough audience. They don't give any. And my other friend who reads them also. So whatever the theoretical construction, I'm always aware, and they will tell me, you know, don't give us any arty horse excreta, you know. You have to pleasure us first. So I suppose I'm always aware in this and in the other book. Actually, in the other book, the monkey is suspended at the edge of death on the condition of pleasure. If you do not give pleasure as a writer, then you're dead. That seems to me essentially true. So I think the idea that life springs from desire and finds its flowering in desire is certainly at the heart for me at the act of writing itself. And therefore, I think the attempt also to do desire in the stories. When I first wrote that, the story, Kama, the one which has the heterosexual lovemaking scene, the love scene actually wasn't in there. Mm. And I got to the end and I thought, there's a hole in here. And then it occurred to me, how can you write a story which is called Kama and make a specific reference in it to the Kama Sutra and not have a sex scene in it? It's just aesthetically dishonest. You've got to do like a big sex scene. So then I went back and constructed it, and of course that became the very center of the story. It's the turning point in the narrative. And I think Sartaj the detective can only solve his mystery once he has had that sex. He can't do it before then. It's through the flesh that he comes to what he calls the first cause.
A final question, which is, what is it like to be an Indian writer writing in America? Has the influence of Rushdie made things easier for you? Do you wish people knew the work of Narayan better? How do you feel about the sudden reemergence, at least over the last several years, of the Partha Panchali trilogy, etc.? Can you speak of this?
I think we live as an Indian writer. I actually spend half my time in India and half in the States. And I think on both sides of the globe, there's, at least in English language publishing, there's a tremendous renaissance in Indian writing. There's every year there's a couple of more major, what I think are major writers. So I think we live in a time of expanding opportunity, and the landscape is larger. So that's very encouraging. As to finding sort of a readership in the West, again, I suppose I would argue that, at least me, I can't really think of that, because it's too large a question. I mean, even within India, when you sit down to tell a story, India is a huge country. Who are you telling the story for? I don't know what they think of it in Mizoram, for instance. And they're in a sense also Indian, and yet their context is so different. So I'm glad it's happening. I don't understand the reasons for it completely, but I think it's a good thing.
I've been speaking to Vikram Chandra, the author most recently of Love and Longing in Bombay, recently published by Little Brown. His first novel, Red Earth and Pouring Rain, has been issued in paperback by Back Bay Books. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for inviting. Thanks.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Jennifer Swadek. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now with Book of the Mouse. Wow.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.